This is Emergency Medicine Match Advice, sponsored by Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, a podcast series designed to help medical students and residents strategically navigate the process of applying for residency in emergency medicine or to EM-sponsored fellowship programs. I'm your host, Mike Gisanti from Stanford University. Let's get started.
Welcome to Emergency Medicine Match Advice, sponsored by the website Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, and its editor-in-chief, the queen bee of medical education herself, Dr. Michelle Lin from UCSF. Hi, Michelle. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Welcome, guys. Looking forward to this chat.
I am too. We have an awesome topic today, one that's critically important at this time of year for senior medical students. What part of the ARIS application really matters? ARIS is a mnemonic, for those that don't know, E-R-A-S, Electronic Residency Application Service. So what parts of that application really matter? We have an all-star panel of guest program directors with us today to help answer that question. So I want to welcome them, Dr. Jean Hearn from Highland General Hospital, Dr. Laura Hobson from University of Michigan, and Dr. Joshua Broder from Duke University. Today's topic is preparing the application itself. And to understand how to accomplish this very stressful task, I think first you need to know the three goals of the application. It has more than one function. There are three goals. The first is to convince the reader, either the program director or one of the selection committee members, to give you an interview, right? You need to get your foot in the door. The second function of the application is to put content, to put fodder in the application for you to have something interesting to be asked about during your interviews. You want enough content in there so that your interviews are fun and fresh and interesting throughout interview season. And then the last is to have a strong enough application to just simply get ranked in a desirable position on the rank order list. And that's a mutually exclusive, perhaps, goal from our first one, which is to get an interview. We'll talk about that as we go through. So an example would be your step one score, right? That's a part of your ARIS application, probably a very important part for getting your foot in the door, for getting an interview. It offers nothing of interest to talk about in your interview. I'd hope interviewers at residencies aren't asking you about your step one score and how you got it. And then we'll talk about some literature at the end that suggests that perhaps your step one and step two score have no meaning at all in terms of how you get ranked. In fact, if you bomb your interview, it doesn't matter what your step one score is. None of the PDs on the panel today are going to rank you very highly. So really one of the three goals accomplished by that part of the application, if you will. The ARIS application is a very challenging task for senior medical students. And I find that our students sometimes worry or obsess about the wrong parts of the application. They'll spend tons of time writing their personal statement. And if we're going to share some secrets today, I'll tell you that I don't really read the personal statements all that much. If you're spending lots and lots of time on that, perhaps it's better spent meeting with your advisor, researching programs online, trying to find an appropriate list of programs for you to apply to. That might be a better use of your time than waxing poetic on blank screen for your personal statement. So there's some literature that I'm going to highlight that might help you in this task. And there's, I'll say admittedly, not all that much out there, but perhaps these three articles, if you look them up, will serve to assist you a little bit in preparing your application. All of them answer the same question, which is what parts of the application do program directors value the most? They have very different study designs and methodologies, and we're not going to get into that sort of journal club aspect of the article today. Really, I'm just going to try to go through them quickly and highlight the key takeaway points from each article. So the first was out of Academic Emergency Medicine in March 2005. It's entitled, What Characteristics of Applicants to Emergency Medicine Predict Future Success as an Emergency Medicine Resident? It was written by Steve Hayden, Marina Hayden, and Anthony Gamst from University of California, San Diego. And the point of the article was actually to help program directors. Steve Hayden postulates that program directors spend inordinate numbers of hours going through thousands of applications that have lots and lots of component parts. And if you could first identify who successful folks in your program are, successful residents, and then look back at their files and say, well, what parts were predictive? How could you predict that they would be successful? Then perhaps when you're screening applications, you could just focus on those component parts. So he found two things were predictive of success at UCSD. One was if you were from a top-tier medical school, top-tier ranked medical school. And the second was if you had what he called a distinctive talent. And it's defined in the article as a champion athlete, so champion athlete, no losers at UCSD, champion athlete, an officer of a national organization, a medical school officer, or if you possess unique training or credentials. These two things were predictive of success at that residency program. And I think there's a takeaway for students. We are in the third week of August right now. The applications are due in about 6 weeks. You can't really affect those parts of your application, right? You can't change medical schools in the next 6 weeks, and you probably can't win some athletic competition to become a champion athlete in the next 6 weeks. So stress off. That's probably not going to really be useful to worry about your application in those ways. Our second article is from WestGem, Western Journal of Emergency Medicine, December 2012, and it's entitled Factors Affecting Candidate Placement on an Emergency Medicine Residency Program Rank Order List. And it was written by Michael Breyer out of Christiana Care, Annie Sodesty out of Mayo Clinic, and Michelle Biros out of University of Minnesota. They identified several items that had a positive correlation with a desirable position on the rank list to be ranked to match. And those included your EM clerkship grade in your fourth year, the global assessment question, the last question on the standardized letter of evaluation, the SLO, and then your class rank in your medical school. And I'll tell you, as a personal secret, that's a big deal here at Northwestern. Class rank's a big deal. Items that had a negative correlation with a desirable rank number were your USMLE Step 1 and Step 2 scores. So we have literature to suggest that step scores really don't matter to the rank order list. And they had a very interesting discussion in this article. They admit that the correlations they did find were quite weak, and they postulate in the discussion that perhaps the interview score alone or other events that occur during interview season probably have a greater impact on where program directors ultimately place a candidate on the rank list than do these component parts. Again, if we consider the goals of the application, these correlates may predict where you are in the rank list, but they have no comment about how to get an interview, right? Again, the step score was a negative correlate, but I would argue that your step score probably would help you get an interview at their program. The last article is out of Academic Medicine in March 2009, entitled Selection Criteria for Residency, Results of a National Program Director Survey. It was written by Marianne Green, an internist here at Northwestern, and Jay Thomas, a physiologist at Northwestern, both associate deans for medical education, and Paul Jones, an otolaryngologist from Rush Medical Center. I should have just said ENT. That was a hard word to say, right? It's a great paper, and not just because it comes out of Northwestern, but because it's very comprehensive. They surveyed 2,500 program directors and 21 different specialties, and they asked them to rank 16 different aspects of the application for what they called importance in selecting applicants, which I take it to mean sort of selecting in the end game, putting them on your rank list and trying to select them in that way. I don't think that they differentiate that this is selecting applicants to interview. And one important point, the 16 different features of the application, they didn't include your interview score. So these are 16 component parts of the ARIS application itself. I really recommend looking this article up because Table 3 is money. It compares each of the 21 different specialties in terms of their preferences for what makes a desirable candidate. So you can compare what a surgery program director and a medicine program director and an EM program director value in their candidates. So for our specialty, the three most important aspects of your application, one, your grades and your senior EM clerkship, two, your recommendation letter, the standardized letter of evaluation, in our case, the SLO, and then your third year required clerkship grade. So we're getting a theme here. The bottom three items were the medical school academic awards that you may or may not have won, published research, and preclinical grades. That was what we valued the least when we were selecting our candidate. So to start our discussion, I want to quote a line from this paper that I think is really interesting. It's in the introduction. It says, "Myths and rumors abound regarding what is really important to program directors and their selection committees about desirable applicants." So panel, we are going to debunk some myths and we are going to tell some truths today about how we actually select our candidate. And our first discussant for that very important task is going to be Dr. Hearn from Highland. Gina, I would appreciate if you would first sort of briefly highlight the various parts of the ARIS application and then comment about what parts really matter to you. You as an individual, your selection committee at Highland, not these other studies, what do you guys care about the most?
Absolutely. So, you know, the ARIS application is a compendium of what you've done in the prior years of your life. And unfortunately, when you get it together, there are very few things that you can still adjust for that. Like Mike said, you may not be able to go out and be an Olympic athlete in the next 6 weeks. So that's a bit of a challenge. The first part of the application is actually the details of your life. It's your list of schools, list of degrees, the jobs you had when you were a volunteer at the swimming pool, when you were in junior high, Okay, maybe not that part, but there, it's a similar type of thing where you sort of list your prior careers, your publications, your awards, etc. It's an essential part, and it's in some ways replicated on your CV, which comes later. The next thing is, of course, the MSP, or the what's formerly known as the Dean's Letter. And that's basically the compendium of recommendation and evaluation that your dean puts together, taking parts of each of your evaluations over the last 4 years and maybe a little bit of time prior to medical school. It also discusses if you've had any challenges during your medical school career, particular highlights. You were class president, you started a homeless clinic, some volunteer work, you did X amount of publications. It also gives you a sense, it gives us as program directors a sense of where you land in comparison to your other classmates. Now, some dean's letters give that very explicitly, and some dean's letters refuse to do that. And it makes our life a little bit more difficult when every single graduate from a particular medical school is like every other amazing graduate from that particular medical school. It actually sort of it handicaps our process a touch. The next thing, of course, is your transcript. It gives a list of when you took the courses, what grades you got, sometimes if there was a pass, honors, high pass, occasionally there's a leave of absence noted there. Then you have your CV, your board scores, USMLE scores, or COMLEX scores, and a personal statement. Now, in terms of what we value, I think actually the academic medicine article is very relevant. I think that what we value as program directors is less your board scores and less of the more precise measurement of how you score on tests, but more how you do in the department. And so, honestly, your letter of recommendation from other emergency medicine programs, I think, holds the most weight. I think emergency medicine is still a relatively small specialty. Most of the program directors know a lot of the other program directors. And having a letter from another program director or another department gives a great indication as to how well an applicant functions in the emergency department. And I think that's probably the most important thing. I think the dean's letter comes in sort of pretty close second, because that also gives you a little more information about the career of that applicant over the last few years. For instance, was there a leave of absence? Did they get honors in every single rotation and they're the top two or three people in their medical school class, or top 10% or top quartile? It really gives you a much broader perspective, and I really appreciate the dean's letters that do that. I think after that comes the rest of your transcript. I mean, in terms of, did you get honors in other rotations? I think many of us see applicants who have done very well in emergency medicine rotations, perhaps got honors there, but then just got a pass in everything else. And that sort of, that gives us a great perspective as to how well they've done in the rest of their medical school career. It may have been that they just found emergency medicine and it's absolutely for them. But I generally think that I generally prefer candidates who do well in emergency medicine clerkships, but also who have done well in the core clerkships, medicine, surgery, peds, etc. And I think that gives me a better sense of how well-rounded they are and how well they will function in the rest of the hospital and in medicine in general. I think that that's really, really helpful for me. After that comes the CV, the board scores, maybe. Well, I think we should spend a lot of time talking about board scores and how much they matter or don't. And then the personal statement. I think the people, we'll talk about personal statements in a little bit probably, but for me, personal statement is probably the lowest thing on my priority list. It lets me know if someone has a problem with grammar or spelling, and it gives me a little sense of insight, but I think that there are clearly people who write very well and maybe have interesting stories, but I also know that there are plenty of people who get a lot of help writing their personal statement, and so for me, it actually holds less weight.
So if we're trying to advise students, particularly those that are going to watch this webcast in the next couple of weeks before the deadline of this application, you know, where can they focus their time? They can't control their class rank. They perhaps can contribute a paragraph or two to the dean's letter, but what parts of the application should they spend their time on? It sounds like personal statement may not be it.
It may not be it. I mean, I think that they need to spend a lot of time making sure that their application is clean, crisp, doesn't have any typos, doesn't have any obvious omissions or errors, because we as program directors pick up on that. So they need to make sure that their application is internally consistent, that there's no gaps, any leave of absence is documented and explained, and I think that that's really important. But after that, they need to spend a lot of time, as you mentioned before, sitting down with their advisor and really getting a great sense as to where they should focus their efforts in terms of applications. There's 170 programs now, and it's very important. You're not going to apply to all of them, and you really need to focus where you are interested. geographically and the type of hospital and setting that you really want. And I think that's going to be more important for you than focusing on rewriting your personal statement 14 times.
So I think you partially answered this question already, but to flip the question around, instead of what you value the most, what parts of the application perhaps are the least important to you guys in your selection committee? Sounds like personal statement, perhaps board scores to some degree. Obviously, you're not discounting board scores entirely. My guess is if someone fails to pass their boards, it's very different than someone who has a Perry average board score in terms of import. Comment on that, the things that are least important.
I would say for us, board scores aren't that important. Yes, if you failed it, that's pretty much the kiss of death. But I've had plenty of chief residents over the years who don't take tests well, and they're amazing clinicians. And so, honestly, for us, it's getting a foot in the door. If you nail your boards and you get 265, great. It sort of raises our eyebrows and say, wow, they can take tests very well. I don't have to worry about them in the in-service exam or passing their actual board exam. But again, I've had so many residents and graduates, some of whom have offices on this hallway, who have done very, very poorly on their board scores, and they still are amazing doctors, and I don't have a problem with that at all.
Yeah, certainly, you know, STEP scores don't predict success as a physician, and you know, we have some studies to point to that. It's interesting you comment that those who become chief resident often don't take tests well. I think there's a lot of chief residents on this panel right now, and you're playing our card about how we did on our tests. So, thanks. Laura, Dr. Hobson from Michigan, we're going to switch gears a little bit, and I'd like you to identify the parts of the application that perhaps the students commonly overlook. Where perhaps would their time be best spent?
So I think echoing Gene's comments that the application as a whole is incredibly important, that this is your opportunity to demonstrate your written communication skills globally and make sure that you are presenting yourself in a clear and succinct manner. You know, what is the overall impression that you can leave with this application package? It's really your overall mission with this ARIS application. And that means you don't need really five paragraph long descriptions of your lifeguarding job when you were in college. You need something short, sweet, to the point that tells me what I need to know about what you did. The rest of the application, really, it's your chance to put down in some sort of written form tangible markers of what your personal characteristics and values are. How do you fill your time? How do you prioritize things? What's your ability to balance extracurricular or non-academic, non-classwork activity and to still uphold a good or still produce a good transcript? And what's your level of insight into your abilities and time prioritization? And to some degree, what level of obsessive compulsiveness do you have? All of which you're trying to display in the best possible light to the program directors who are reading your application. I think small things matter. So silly things that may disqualify people that people maybe should be putting more time into. The photo, make sure it's professional. Selfies don't necessarily look great. Neither do feather boas. Beer should never make an appearance in your photo. And going too far the other direction and having a photo taken in someone's office with a leather-lined chair and a whole bunch of diplomas behind them also looks kind of goofy. So make sure the photo's professional but concordant with who you are, which is generally a medical student. I think the other area that I see a lot of time not spent on is employment history. Whether you worked in fast food or in a previous, you know, consulting or legal job, put it down. Get down what you did in, again, a clear and succinct manner because it matters. And probably the volunteer activities, the one-day volunteer activities, really are not that important, and you don't need to worry about collating, you know, I showed up for one day to do shovel someone's sidewalk. You know, you get sort of, okay, you're a nice person points for that, but not necessarily a whole lot. There's not necessarily a whole lot added to your application for little details along that line.
You raised two great points, and perhaps the photo is the thing that I appreciate the most. And Gene will tell us his favorite photos in a little bit. Look at him. He's got 10 of them already in his head.
I've got them in a drawer, actually, if you want me to. I can just hold them up.
That'll be a great way to end. Yes, that'll be our pitfall section. But more importantly, you comment on this ability to multitask and have competing priorities and still succeed. You're either saying comment on that in your personal statement, but I think perhaps what becomes implied from your CV is, yeah, I was a D1 athlete and I worked 30 hours a week trying to pay for medical school. And look, I did this research project, and I scored pretty well in my third-year clerkships. So you start to imply that, you know, they were a busy person. And, you know, I agree, when you start to see the CV have details, I worked one or 2 hours, 1 week, a year in this volunteer experience, and that's the extent of it. Well, that really wasn't competing for your time. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I'd much rather see someone doing average but juggling a heavy workload to support themselves than scoring through the roof and doing nothing else, because that doesn't tell me that they're going to be able to handle the many competing demands of a life in emergency medicine, let alone residency.
Good. Well, I think that's hopefully going to lower the stress level for some folks out there as they hear that. I think that's really important. What parts of the application have the most potential for a mistake? Where can the fatal errors occur when the students are filling out the ARIS application?
So the whole thing's probably a minefield, and you could probably screw up any portion that you wanted to.
And the stress level went right back up, Laura. Thank you.
Now, you said I was being too encouraging, so now I got to discourage people.
I like that.
I think big red flag, or the big areas that I think people are going to get into pitfalls with, are there's that lovely section about disclosing any misdemeanors and felonies, as well as any interruptions in your medical training. Making sure that if you have something that fills into those categories, that you get good advice from your dean's office as well as advisors as to how exactly you should fill that in. Other people can chime in their opinions on this, but I'm a big believer in the fact that it's not necessarily, to a large degree, it's not necessarily the mistake, but how you recover from it and what you learn from it and can apply to your future life experiences that's really what is important. So the fact that you had to take a leave because you had a family illness, or the fact that you did have a significant traffic violation, that's not necessarily fine, but it's not necessarily the kiss of death unless you present it in such a way that you either haven't learned from it, or it took over your life, or you're at risk to do the same thing again. So get some good advice on that.
How about the grammar typos that Jean alluded to?
Seems to me you've got several months to have multiple people proofread this, in addition to a Word program that puts nice green and red squiggly lines under things that it doesn't like. So there better not be maybe more than one. You get one free grammar typo in my book. Once I see more than that, I start to worry about your attention to detail, and does that carry over into the clinical environment? Are you going to be sloppy when it really matters and that's taking care of people?
Absolutely. This is where I think the personal statement actually potentially can hurt you the most. It's not really the content, it's the grammar and your ability to write and describe something. Because you're going to have to write and describe things the rest of your life. Even if you're not in academics and research, you're writing charts all day long that tell the narrative of a patient's experience, and I'd like you to be able to write that well. And certainly grammar becomes, and typos especially, become a big, as you say, minefield. This is your first job application for many of the students out there. And it is a job application, and would you ever submit a job application that had a typo? Absolutely not. So if you take that perspective on this, certainly you see the import of having folks double check your work. I do want to point out that I believe when you're typing your application, it doesn't autocorrect your spelling and things. You need to import it from Word as sort of a copy paste, but that's simply easy enough to do.
And it, at least in years past, has done something funky with imports from Words and added some bizarre characters in there.
I mean, it's so different than our experience when we had a stone and we had to, different than submitting it online today, certainly. All right, Dr. Broder, we've talked a lot about step scores and class rank and grades. There's a lot of numbers in there. And for the student who perhaps is a really great fit for emergency medicine and a great clinician, but maybe doesn't have those awesome scores, how do they shine in their application? What parts of the application can they highlight their strengths?
Thanks for inviting me to the conversation. I hope you can hear me. We had some trouble before. I'm very excited to be here, and I would say that if you're really worried about your scores, you should reach out to the program director in advance. I'm probably endangering my participation here. The others are going to bludgeon me over the internet for bringing this up. But I've had some problem children in the past apply to our program, and what I mean by that is people who scored badly or had trouble on adapting to emergency medicine initially. And I really valued the fact that they had an open communication with me and discussed those problems. Now, to be fair, that doesn't mean that every program is going to delight in applicants who have some MAR on their record. And I typically reached out to other people at the institution that they were coming from to find out, is this person presenting an accurate depiction of why they had trouble? Have they recovered? As a lot of people said, it's not the trouble you face, but how you adapted to it that matters. We're all human beings. I think that this is a very stressful application process for medical students, but we're human beings who face difficulties ourselves. We also have some humor, otherwise we probably couldn't handle the job if we didn't have an element of humor. I wanted to share with you also my distinguishing talent that got me into residency at University of Maryland, and Annie Sadasti asked me about it during, I think, my interview there, which was, I'm a professional nose harmonica player. You can ask me again later. But if you make it in the door with low scores, you should forget about them during your interview and through. I think the most important things I value are teamwork and a real commitment to it. And I don't care one bit if I've invited you to interview. I'm already past the board scores, and I want to know, how are you going to help the team when things are not looking good and other people need you? And what have you done in the past that shows that you really come through in that circumstance? And how are you innovative? How are you planning to contribute in some way to the residency community you're joining and ultimately to the field of emergency medicine? I don't think that means that you have to tell people that you're going to cure some dread disease or go out and help people a world away. Sometimes it's very local ways of depicting your commitment to your community that really mean a lot.
So those are great comments, Josh. You know, you're having a little bit of tough technical difficulty. I could hear everything well. I'm not seeing your video. So Okay. Perhaps I'll throw the follow-up back to Gene. Josh is a nice guy. We all know that. And he'll enter a discourse with, it sounds like, any thoughtful applicant. But there's got to be a way for some of these students to discuss potential red flags in their file or the ways that they overcame those challenges in their file so that we can all see it without sort of getting into individual conversations, right? You and I probably see 1,000 applications and we're not well suited to taking 1,000 phone calls individually. So where can they describe those sorts of things?
I think the personal statement is probably the easiest place to do it. Usually people will do a small section like, you know, I faced challenges when I took the USMLE Part 1 because I had a death in the family. I recommitted to it and took it again and passed with flying colors, etc. So making some comment about the situations. And, you know, life happens, and I absolutely understand that. And deaths in the family or breakups of relationships, those can be devastating. And as long as you demonstrate that you've been able to bounce back, as Laura said, that is the nugget which allows us to look in and see what kind of person you really are. And so we have all faced challenges. If we haven't faced challenges, we haven't lived long enough. And it's recovering from those challenges that really sort of tests your mettle and tells you how well you'll work on a Saturday night with people hanging from the rafters and the busload of folks that just came in.
Yeah, it really gets at resilience, right? I mean, that's a great predictor of success in residency. And if you have the opportunity to describe an example, you know, it's unfortunate that life happens, but you know how you recover, that really can be very instructive for us as we evaluate your application. I still don't see Josh on the screen here, so we're going to go to Laura. So Gene suggests that they put it in their personal statement. I revealed a secret earlier that I don't read 1,000 personal statements this time every year. So where else can it happen? You know, my thought is our letters of recommendation for one another, right? If you're meeting with your advisor, is there a way for important information to be communicated on your behalf?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best place to get it in. I admit the personal statement's usually the last thing I look at when I'm flipping an application, and usually that's a 5-10 second quick glance through to make sure there's nothing too dramatic that I need to know about before that yes interview, no interview decision gets made. But if I have a letter from someone that I know and respect that says, hey, this is a guy or a gal who plugged through a lot of adversity during medical school, they've got a ton of potential, and I think you should take a chance on them, that means a lot. So engage for a student, if you've got something that made your medical school career or your life a little rockier than normal, engage your advisor and your advocate in that discussion, and that may get you a lot of mileage and your foot in a fair number of doors.
Looks like you're back, Dr. Broder. Thanks. What further comments do you have on this?
Well, I don't mean that I'm inviting a flood of 10,000 callers, but it really does mean something to me as a program director if someone really wants to be at my program. If there's a connection that ties them to the Research Triangle, Duke University, North Carolina, the East Coast, it matters because I want people who want to be here. And to me, that's one of the best predictors of performance, is that someone really wanted to be here, is thrilled when they match in our program, and wants to grow the program and make it a better place for the people who follow. So communicating that through the personal statement or a phone call or a brief, I emphasize brief, email explaining why I should just look out for their application, I'm willing to respond to that.
Dr. Lin, why don't you interject some wisdom in our conversation at this point?
I echo all of your comments also, and I apologize because I put Josh on the witness protection program, so I had his screen purposely blanked out, so I guess he's off the list now. He's legit. I do thank you for all your comments, and the one thing I do worry, the thing that we all seem to be focusing on is the personal statement. And when I used to read these, I agree, like the 800th application, that's the last thing you want to read because they all start sounding the same after a while. But I do want to say that, you know, do spend some time on it, not just so much for the grammar issues, but I think in the next stage of interviewing, as an interviewer, this is kind of where we pick up all the fodder about what to talk about. So don't think it's just going to be glossed over one and done. It's a gift that keeps on giving. So if you just be ready to talk about what you put on your personal statement. And then I want to kind of change gears, and we talked about, Laura mentioned this, which is there is a huge minefield about what could go wrong with your ARIS application. And a lot of it you can't really change, right? So, but what you can go wrong, what can go wrong is issues of honesty on your application. And none of you really talked about it yet. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about, for instance, without giving too much detail, but, you know, when you put down, I work 10 hours on this job per week, and I work 10 hours on this research project we get, and I work 10 hours on this per week, you know, it doesn't really add up, right? It's 30 hours a day. Oh, no, sorry, you work, you know, 10 hours a day on each of these projects, it adds up to 30 hours a day, and it doesn't make sense. You know, what do you do with someone like that with who has fairly egregious numbers that you know is not true? How do you deal with that in terms of stretching the truth on the ARIS applications?
Gene, do you want to tackle that first?
Sure. Eric Katz and I did a study maybe 10 years ago where we actually took a bunch of applications and then looked through them for errors, omissions, or, for instance, changing the location of the authorship, and we found a pretty significant rate of errors. I think it was like 10-15%, not insignificant ones either. And, you know, honestly, you need to know your application inside out and backwards and forwards, because your interviewer will ask you about that time you spent at the kindergarten as a teacher's aide. And if you hand wave and fluffle a little bit about that, it's going to come out as you adding in extra stuff to your application just because it looks good. So you really need to know everything you did, every research project you were involved in, because when your interviewers ask you about that project, you should remember it. You should know what your contribution was, and you should be able to talk about it and what the next stages were, if anything else comes across as disingenuous.
Laura?
I think anything that raises concerns about someone's integrity is a huge red flag. And the advantage we have is we get to see the dean's letter next to the transcript, next to the ARIS application, including your CV, next to your letters of recommendation, and inconsistencies pop up, not infrequently. And usually it doesn't fall in the applicant's favor, rightly or wrongly, because they're so making sure that you know what's in your dean's letter, that if you're reporting honors grades under your awards section, that you get the correct rotations cited on there, whether or not the receipt of an honors actually mattered to you, making sure 115% that your citations are correct and the dates of where you presented them are correct. So I think all of that really plays into the overall picture of an applicant and is critically important.
Yeah, certainly the misrepresentation of your role on a research project has become a hot topic for, you know, many specialties, and certainly if you look that up in the literature, you're going to find that we're paying attention. Dr. Broder, do you have any stories to tell?
The application process, I would just echo that, I mean, integrity is key to what we do. We're relying on, when a resident joins our program, we're going to be relying on them to convey the most critical information to us in the most accurate way. And so if there's one part of the application that I simply couldn't tolerate, it's not being honest. So not that I've ever run into that in my entire career.
Michelle, he's not taking my bait. You know, there's folklore out there of the I played guitar and someone pulls the guitar out of their closet and I speak French and je parle français comes out of their mouth, right? So give me a story. I need a story.
I did have one applicant who'd saved a life, and I didn't ask him to demonstrate that one again. But, you know, this gets to the problem of the personal statement. Some people have had remarkable life events confront them, and in some ways capitalize on it in your personal statement by describing something that sounds like, you know, I was a member of the CIA and I dropped in on a Black Hawk and rescued someone, but not all of us have that. So I don't expect that to come out. I may have pulled out the harmonica during the interview, so I don't want to. I won't hold that against people.
All right, pearls and pitfalls. To close this, I'd like to hear just briefly the do's and don'ts of the application from the PD perspective. We'll start with you, Gene.
Pearls and pitfalls. I think that for me, writing a personal statement that is off the wall has tremendous risk. I think that 95% of our personal statements read about the same. There was a significant life event. This is why I'm a good team player. I love emergency medicine. Please let me be a team player at your program. That's probably 95% of the personal statements. I remember a personal statement. I remember two of note, one good and one bad. The good one was I actually had one of my chief residents years ago wrote his personal statement as his own obituary, and it was stunningly written. It was phenomenal. And we read that, and we said, this is an amazing person, and he is a faculty member at a very well-known university institution now. And we also had somebody who grew up or had an interest in incubating eggs and talked about the Octagon 3000 egg incubator, and we said, we took a bit, we're like, all right, done. And
was that a good thing? Onto the good pile or the bad pile?
That was the bad pile.
The incubator is bad at Highland, got it.
Like, wow, that was just odd. And I think that you run that risk by doing an off-the-wall personal statement. It can be amazing, but it can also make people read it and say, wow, this person's a little strange. And I think that the clarification for us and the reason why the letters from other program or other program directors is so important is that you can be brilliant. You can be an amazing clinician and not get along well with the nurses or other residents or the other med students, and you can clearly get honors in some place because you are a great clinician. But if you don't play well with others in the sandbox, we don't want you in our program. And I think that that's truly the key. Like, you can get honors in a lot of different things because you're obviously smart and you may be a brilliant person. But for emergency medicine, it's more about the teamwork, and I think that's the key.
Well, there's a reason that 95% of the personal statements are safe, because they're safe.
Right.
And the risk of creative writing, the risk of humor, those are real risks for the writer, I agree. Dr. Hobson, pearls and pitfalls about the ARIS application.
Be yourself. Let your ARIS application accurately reflect who you are, and you're probably doing better than playing a game and making up someone else who isn't real.
I love that. I read the personal statements for those students who are interested in my comments at Northwestern. And really, I look for content, tone, and authenticity. The rotation is enough time for me to get to know many of them, and sometimes they don't ring true. So I agree, authenticity is very important. Josh?
I've heard a couple of things that I agree with. One is risk stratification. That's what our field is about. And when I hear our group talking after the interview day, that we talk a lot about upside risk or downside risk and upside potential. And we tend to err a little bit more on the side of minimizing the downside potential. The other part is congruence of what we saw on paper and what we met, the person we met during the interview day. And I think it's totally true. If there's just a mismatch, you kind of wonder what you're going to get. And if there's great congruence, really, it helps the application. Usually, the reason we invited you was you had good stuff on paper. And if what we meet in person, the person is congruent with that, it's a done deal in the good column.
Certainly, I think most of us are risk averse when it comes to this process, so that's a very important point. Michelle, take us home. What were your takeaways from today's discussion?
Well, I think initially it was everyone's going to be fine, and then we upped the ante a little bit, like, no one's going to be fine. Just watch out.
It was only a matter of time with this group.
Yeah, don't turn anything in.
Actually,
Go into family practice. I think it's just being very cognizant about what you put on paper. This is your one time for that paper-based first impression for the program directors to try to start to get to know you. There's just so many points to tackle. And as a side note, in terms of becoming a national athlete, I'm still holding out for like the curling championship that I think I could take. I think I can do it. So I'm not.
I will be on your team. I would love to be.
Nice, like the little broomers. I could do that.
Yeah.
I think it's still possible, so I wouldn't rule that off of anyone's list. But I'd love to hear what everyone else has to say.
I'm going to go through a real quick question for all three of you. I want very brief answers. What is the drop-dead deadline for this application? Gene?
Honestly, October 5th.
Okay, Laura?
Probably second week of October.
Okay, Josh?
Same thing, 30,000 pages to read when we get these, so need some time to do.
I'm going
to
push the envelope and say October 1st. When that dean's letter comes out, I hit data dump on the host computer here and you know, I'll look at it again at our big selection committee meeting a week later. Then I'm sort of done going to the mailbox, so to speak. So get it in early. I think the early bird gets the worm in a whole lot of ways, and certainly around this application.
Can I interject real quick? Sorry to interrupt you guys, but yeah. I've heard rumors of some programs that do more of a rolling interview selection process, meaning they rock on all their numbers. Do I really need to wait for that dean's letter to know that they rock? And so what do you think about that in terms of should I get it in super early for those few programs that actually start offering interviews early?
Josh, why don't you start?
I definitely will look at an application when it comes in, but I don't want to have to go through the box dozens of times, but on the other hand, top applicants are probably going to be saturated with interview offers early, so we do certainly look as soon as they're available.
Gene?
Yeah, we look early. I think we have a high-value target pile, perhaps, and that as soon as the dean's letters come out, we will look at that pile first, and if there's congruence, we'll offer interviews within a day or so. So we generally don't offer until October 1st, just because we found interesting things in the dean's letters that wouldn't necessarily come out otherwise. So we refrain from offering any interviews before October 1st. That being said, we're ready to go pretty quick after that happens.
Laura?
Yeah, I'm with Gene. Especially now that the dean's letter's out October 1st, there's no reason not to look at it. And sometimes there's some really interesting things, both pro and con, hidden in there.
Yeah, we always waited for the dean's letter, even when it was released in November. We were one of the last, I think, to offer interviews. And now that it's October 1st, we've moved our whole process up. Certainly, we're pretty quick after the dean's letter. It's usually about a week, and we have majority of our invites out. And the rolling process doesn't occur, at least at this institution. And I'll say before October 1st, I'm in just Pleasantville denial and will absolutely not open the mailbox. So it's like overnight it all begins.
Application season, what application season?
That's right. Yeah.
I go on vacation.
That's right. All right. Well, you know, I think this has been a really great discussion. I'm very grateful to our PDs who took the time this morning, very early, look at the coffee, very early on the West Coast for some. So as a thank you, I'd like to give you an opportunity to sell your program to our viewer audience. So we're going to do that by telling me something that I don't know about your program. So we're going to start with you, Gene. Tell me something I don't know about Highland.
Highland, there's a lot of stuff a lot of people know about Highland. That's the problem. Highland is the small liberal arts college of emergency medicine programs.
That's outstanding. Which college? Is it a little McAllister? Is it a little Middlebury? What are we talking?
Pomona.
Pomona. Oh, good choice. Good choice.
It's California. It's sunny. I have to say that.
Do you want to expand on that at all?
Well, sure. There are fantastic programs, and everybody on this Hangout is at an amazing program, and I think applicants will do well in a lot of different places. Our Highland is unique in that it's pretty small. I have 18 full-time faculty who all teach a full clinical load, and so that's really what we do. We do research, but it's not a huge portion of our mission statement. We're here to teach residents. The chairman, the vice chair have all been program directors for at least 10 years, and that's really what we do. So if you're looking for a big university program with a huge research budget, that's not us. But we're a big county program with a lot of trauma and happens to be in San Francisco Bay Area.
I left Reed College for just dangling in the air for you. You didn't take
that one. I love it. Not quite Reed.
The students have no idea what we're talking about now.
Right.
There's no question I'm one of your biggest fans, and you can tell that by volume of Northwestern students told to apply to your program. So students, definitely check out Highland. Laura, tell me something I don't know about a fellow Big Ten University of Michigan.
Well, one of my former chiefs and current faculty members is insistent that Chicago has colder winter weather than Ann Arbor. So apparently we're not that far into the Arctic tundra. We're obviously based in Ann Arbor, but we've got a great patient diversity. We send our folks up to Flint, Michigan for some hardcore trauma underserved population experience, as well as partner with a local community hospital, St. Joseph Mercy Hospital. And I think we've got just a tremendous patient population and diversity of experiences coupled with really terrific people here.
Yeah, I will say I love the Michigan program. On paper, you guys are incredibly similar to Northwestern. We both do a lot of critical care time, and I respect you guys for that. I think it's wonderful. Josh, tell me something I don't know about Duke.
I think everyone thinks we're still the newest program in emergency medicine. I've been here personally 9 years, and the program is in its 12th year of the residency. And though we're a small college town, we get our fair share of knife and gun clubs. We get gunshot wounds. If I were a realtor, I couldn't share this information with you. We're also really lucky to be at an innovative leading university. I work with biomedical engineers and ultrasound development right across the street from my office. So it's a terrific place to be. It's a warm and fuzzy place, which I don't think people necessarily think of when they think Duke, but every resident has been to my house. I've played guitar for them. They've scoped me and shocked me and held my kids. So it's that kind of a place.
Yeah, you know, something I don't know, and we all know that you're the hardest working man in showbiz down there, Josh. So you run a great program. We've got some Northwestern folks that have migrated to more pleasant weather and have been working at your shop with nothing but rave reviews. So thanks to all three panelists. Michelle, thank you to Academic Life for hosting today's Google Hangout, and we'll see you with the next topic.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Emergency Medicine Match Advice. You can view any of our episodes for free on Allium's YouTube channel, or if you prefer, listen to the episodes as Allium podcasts on SoundCloud. Also, check out summaries of our episodes as blog posts on Allium.com and in the publication A User's Guide to the Allium EM Match Advice series in the June 2017 issue of the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine. We love to hear from our listeners. Post your questions or comments for any of our episodes on Allium.com. Thanks for joining us.